sanction Elbit now. Elbit out of Canada, as Bobby has said.
Elbit out of Canada!
Elbit out of Canada!
Sanction Elbit now!
Sanction Elbit now!
And now to provide a little counterbalance to our cacophony. No protest is complete without hearing from our great social and ecological justice troubadours, the Raging Grannies.
You want the mic? You want the mic?
Last night I had the strangest dream I've ever dreamed before. I dreamed the world had to put an end to war. I dreamed I saw a mighty room filled with women and men, and the painters they were signing said they'll never fight again. And when the papers were signed and a million copies made, they all joined hands and bowed their heads and grateful prayers were prayed. And the people in the streets below were dancing round and round, and guns and swords and uniforms were scattered all around. Last night I had the strangest dream I've ever dreamed before. I dreamed the world had all agreed to put an end to war.
Right on.
Thank you, Grannies, for always lifting us up with song. As Pete Seeger said, a singing movement is a winning movement.
Woo! Hey, I just, Bobby, yeah. Bobby, photo in front of his
Okay,
office.
Yeah, we're going to take the family photo. Before we do, let me just I'll make the parting words here. I want to say, and I think we all feel this, is that these actions cannot be one-offs, that we need sustained pressure on this member of parliament. We cannot let him wiggle away from doing the most obvious thing, which is the responsibility of government to sanction companies that are directly profiting from war crimes, including the crime of crimes, which is the crime of genocide.
Right.
And so I at the last rally, I asked everybody, is if there's anybody here that is interested in a door-to-door campaign to get Will Greaves to advocate in Ottawa to sanction Elbit, talk to me after the rally. We'll put together a small crew. If we can go door to door for our comrade here, Peter Gibbs, who's running for City Hall, when we can go door to door for the Palestinian people, right? We can. That's not the only time to go door to door. It's not when you're voting someone into public office, right? And I know Peter's nodding vociferously there. So please talk to me after the event. And again, I want to thank you all for coming out and doing the obvious thing, which should be plain as daylight to Mr. Greaves, to stop supporting and enabling and legitimizing and legalizing the activities of a company that is directly profiting off the death and destruction and genocide of an entire people in Palestine. Thank you, everybody, for being here. And we're going to go over to the door of the office and we're going to take a family photo.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favourite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, however, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
Smoke blocking out the sun, like right around here. But-
But in the occupied West Bank, the sources of the flames are soldiers and settlers with addresses and names. I know you're busy, but to whom it may concern, the hilltop boys are chanting, may your village burn. While you evacuate cities filled with smoke, with walls of fire approaching like the wrath of God awoke. The wrath of the Israeli settlers is torching mosques and homes and killing entire families wherever they roam. I know you're busy, but to whom it may concern, the hilltop boys are chanting, may your village burn. I know you're busy, but to whom it may concern, the hilltop boys are chanting, may your village burn. I know you're busy, but to whom it may concern, the hilltop boys are chanting, may village burn.
Iconic activist, scholar, and former leader of the Green Party of Canada, Joan Russo, died August 6th. Joan founded the Global Compliance Research Project, whose work digging through international law and compliance with environmental agreements already signed but not ratified, and those ratified but not acted upon, is a signal effort. Joan was a frequent guest on this program going back to the year 2000, and I feature today a conversation we had as she readied to go down to Venezuela in 2012. Welcome back to the program, Joan.
Thank you.
Well, now, Joan, what are you? You're going all the way down to Venezuela to get some more footage for your latest project. Now,
not really the latest project. I should explain that
okay.
The cooperatism counterpoint to corporatism was a project really initiated in 2008 by filmmaker Steve Poole and myself, and we filmed co-ops in Europe and cooperative conferences in Europe in 2008. And this year is in 2012, it's the International Year of the Cooperatives. So Steve Poole has been starting to edit a lot of the footage that we took before, and so now I'm going down to get some more footage in Venezuela, because this is a very nice complement to what we were seeing in Europe.
Oh, and of course, Steve is Lazarus Productions. He works a lot with Jack Etkin doing the face-to-face program that you see
yes,
on
he
Shaw.
Does all the video work and editing and so forth.
Yeah, he's a hard-working guy. So what is there something specific you're going to shoot while you're down there?
Well, I'm going to be staying at an institute that was founded in 1959, and one of their interests at the time was encouraging cooperatives. And this institute is spending a lot of time researching cooperatives and actually working on the ground with cooperatives. So I'll have a chance to work with them and doing some videotaping. And the person who runs the institute wrote a book, After Capitalism. So I think it's a good place to really be based in order to take some good footage. But I don't know what I'll probably be filming other things as well, because who knows what's going to happen in Venezuela.
Well, yeah.
So there's an election going. The election will be in October 7th, I believe. So I might be filming other things as well. But the mission, what he has done since he became president is quite extraordinary. He started out with a Plan Bolivar, which created thousands of schools, hospitals, clinics, homes, churches. All these were over a period of several years. And then there was also the missions that were very similar in a way to cooperatives, and there were missions that were involved with education, primary education. Also, there was a major literacy program I think was based on the Cuban model. Also, food cooperatives, and I think at one point there were about 150 cooperatives. I don't think there are quite so many now. I think it's down to 50,000. I mean, 120,000, and it's down to about 50,000.
50,000 cooperatives in a country the size of Venezuela. Well, of course, Hugo Chavez, he just celebrated the 10th anniversary of the 2002 coup attempt against him. One of the most amazing stories, I think, that I've ever covered, and so gratifying, too, the way he reversed it and so quickly as well.
But, yes, yes. He came back specially to be around. He came back from Cuba because he's been undergoing treatment in Cuba. Yeah. So he came back to be there for the celebration, but I don't think he was speaking. He was there participating, but not. He didn't speak for a long time anyway, if he did speak. And now he's gone back to Cuba.
Well, of course, he's undergoing chemo and other treatments for cancer, an undisclosed variety of it in Cuba, as you mentioned, of course. And and Venezuela did all that great deal of trading oil to Cuba in return for they sending doctors over and setting up clinics,
yes,
and so forth.
Yes, because the Cuban doctors were very active in setting up the cooperative related to community health. And but the person who's running against him, Enrique Capriles Radinsky or something, and he compares himself to Lula, and he's also, I was going through some press clippings about him, and he seems to be going into the poorer areas day by day and sort of presenting himself as being the energetic young person to take over in contrast. So I just hope the loyalty to Chavez will be maintained.
Well, of course, the American press, I was listening to them last night, and they were sort of writing Chavez's epitaph, really. I think it was on the CBC, too. But they're saying, well, you know, Chavez has made this great mistake of not grooming a successor, because they're all putting him underground because of the cancer right now, you know. But I think he's alive and well just yet. But one of the things we didn't mention, Joan, one of the things that Chavez did set up is also media co-ops of citizen journalism and dozens and dozens and dozens of radio and television stations to counteract the overwhelmingly corporate and elite-controlled media that exists in Venezuela.
Oh, there were many things that they set up. There were certainly agricultural co-ops. There was the famous orchestra that was set up, I think, that's traveling all over.
Mm-hmm.
There was urban land reform. And, of course, this is one that the opposition is very concerned about because a lot of the land was taken away and redistributed. Of course, that would bother the opposition. Now, the opposition seems to be united behind this candidate that's running against him. But what he's trying to do, so he's sort of got the very strong right-wing vote, and now he's supposedly going into all the barrios. And every time he finds someone that has changed from being a supporter of Chavez, somehow it gets into the news that this person is no longer supporting Chavez. So it's really difficult. Not only is he having to fight cancer, but he has to also deal with this. I believe it's the first time that he's considered to have had a real opponent, and the opponent claims that he's center left,
mm-hmm.
in order to try to get some of the votes. But I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, you mentioned Lula, that from Brazil, and he presented himself as a left wing guy, but he managed to keep the country's elite satisfied to some degree, and he managed to leave power still popular, which is quite a feat. But you're going to be going back now. It's hard to believe, Joan, but it's been 20 years since the Rio climate change.
Well, actually, I wanted to say a bit more about Lula. I think he was considered to be a socialist when he got in, but
mm-hmm.
after his tenure, I don't think people felt that he was a socialist anymore.
Well, yeah, this was the thing, but he still, what I heard was that he retained like an 80% popularity rate.
Oh, yes, he certainly retained a large percentage of the popular vote. Yes, yeah, so going back to Rio 20 years later,
mm-hmm.
and I remember when I was in Rio, I felt that the documents were not strong enough, what they agreed to, and then I would go back, I remember going back, well, that was in 1992, and then I went back in 1997, to Rio Plus Five, and the only thing they could agree to in Rio Plus Five was that they hadn't fulfilled anything that they had undertaken to do at the Rio conference. And then I went to the one in South Africa that was called the World Conference on Sustainable Development, and there was a lot of intrusion of WTO language and a lot of weakening of the stronger language that had been there before. So it's gradually deteriorated over the years. So I wasn't going to go, actually. But I felt that it's really important for people who were there in the very beginning to go back and remind them of what they have not lived up to. And there were some of the principles that came out of Rio were very, very strong, such as the precautionary principle. Mm-hmm. And the big problem is these principles were there, but they didn't really determine what would constitute compliance with the principles. And I think that's what needs to be done in Rio, to point out that they can't just give lip service. You know, often they say, well, we're going to respect all the documents from before, but they don't say specifically which documents and how they're going to respect them. And certainly there's been little evidence that they've been carrying out the obligations or fulfilling the obligations that they agreed to. I think one thing that I really want to stress is the fact that, and a lot of people don't realize that, because there was a document called Agenda 21, and it had 33 chapters, and often people didn't read, you know, can you imagine, 800 pages of 33 chapters. Not many people read the whole document. But hidden away in the 33rd chapter was a firm commitment to reallocate military expenses. And so this is something that I really want to keep reminding them of. And when I went to the climate change conferences, you know, they'd stand up there and say, where are we going to get the money to help the poor developing countries to address the issue of climate change that we've really imposed on them? And I would always say at press conferences, well, you did undertake to reallocate military expenses. So,
and nobody's offering to cut those that I can tell, at least not in the West, anyway.
They find anything else to cut but that.
Yeah, well, of course. Now, well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking tonight with Joan Russo, and Joan's a former leader of the Green Party of Canada. As a reporter, she attended the climate change conferences, as we mentioned, in Copenhagen and Cancun, and she's been working with a videographer, that would be Steve Poole, on the video Cooperatives, Counterpoint to Capitalism, and she's going back to Venezuela to get more footage to complete that project. And the Canadian Voices of Women for Peace is helping you get down to Rio, right, Joan?
Yes, well, I'm there. I'm one of their New York representatives. So they have a special status at the UN, and they can really support people to go to any of the conferences. Many NGOs can only go to the conferences that they are specifically involved in when there are issues that they're specifically involved in. For example, the environmental NGOs can only really go to environmental conferences, but if they have this special status, which is called ECOSOC status, which doesn't really matter the name, but they are entitled to send people to any of the conferences. So that's why I want to raise peace issues as well when I'm there, of course.
Well, peace and environment, I mean, the greatest single consumer of fossil fuels on the planet is the American military.
Oh, absolutely, and you know, the International Governmental Panel on Climate Change does not have a separate category for determining the contribution of militarism to greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, while we're asked to change light bulbs and sacrifice it, well, that's not sacrifice in some way, the military is not monitored really at all. And, of course, that's one of the big problems with the climate change conference. And I don't know how much, I suppose, climate change will be dealt with. You know, every time when there is one of these conferences, they say, well, we've got to link all the issues, because as you were pointing out, there's really peace and environment and social justice and human rights, where you were mentioning about environment and peace being very directly related. But all these issues are very related, anti-poverty and so forth, and health. All these are vitally interconnected, and it's so important to raise all these issues at once. And that was really what Rio was doing in this document, Agenda 21. They had chapters, they had I think there were 36 chapters altogether, actually, but they were dealing with a wide range of topics, including housing and anti-poverty and health care. You know, there were a wide range of topics, and so this seems to have been lost over the years. But I think I was hoping that that's what Rio Plus 20 would be doing, really stressing how they are finally going to integrate all these issues and to implement the principles that were agreed to in Rio.
Well, it is kind of discouraging to consider. I mean, I remember one of the leading lights, if you want, of Rio 92 was the address given by David Suzuki's young daughter, whose first name eludes me right now.
Severin, I believe it is.
Severin, right, of course. Severin is a...
She was only 13, I believe.
12 or 13 years of age, and now, of course, she's a mom. She lives up in Haida Gwaii. She's a grown woman. And yet, how far have we come, Joan, since the 92...
Well, conference? I remember when I was at the 2002 meeting, I was referring to it as Rio minus 20.
Yeah.
know, it's just, I mean, sadly, we're really going backwards. And they're changing the language, too. I've noticed this over the years at the UN, that there used to be really strong, there was strong language up until about 1996. And, they, for instance, well, they would talk in shells, not just should or possibly or if possible, you know, all these conditionals. It was very, very definite, the language, about there's one declaration on eliminating hunger. We must or we shall eliminate hunger by the year 2000. Mm-hmm. You know, I've gone through all these documents and the promises that have been made once, and all the promises they made, we will do this by such and such a date. We will be, you know, I've got pages and pages of things that they've undertaken to do. And that's why I started the Global Compliance Research Project, right, to monitor governments to find out what they, you know, what they agreed to before and what they haven't done.
Well, yeah, the Compliance Project, and again, this is, I mean, you know, there's such a thing as being, you know, shooting on people. Every time you hear a politician, you know, when they're put on the spot, then they come back with, you know, the mom and apple pie answer, but they always insert that one word that shoulds on it, and we should seek to do this, and we should try to do that, and we should, in all good conscience, do this, which is absolutely bullshit.
Yeah.
Couldn't help it. I had to get
Well, it is, and you know, I wrote a book in for the Women's Conference in 1985. It was 350 pages of what governments have agreed to internationally. And I was talking to someone, one of the delegates, just before the conference opened, and I told the delegate about the book I'd written. She said, "Oh, that's really important because we never remember what we've agreed to, and this is the big problem. So it's really important for people to go and remind them, because year after year, they send new people to these conferences. And often what happens in one of the documents, for example, every state undertook to ensure that corporations, including transnational corporations, comply with all international law, including all international environmental law. Well, that was not agreed to by the sections of the government that were supposed to be dealing with the environment. It was under a section that was related to labor. And so you find that if you read the whole document, you can find in one section they've agreed to something that actually applies to another. And in the, I don't know if I'm explaining this properly, but in the section, for example, that would be dealing with environment, they'd send people there, particularly the Canadian government, to make sure that they wouldn't agree to anything that was too strong. But then in the section where labor might be involved, the people involved with labor might say, well, yes, we should get them to comply. So, you know, it's really interesting going through the documents and seeing how it varies. And
well, there's that word again, too, that they should comply, and there's a lot of things that we should do. And talking about labor, I've just recently read an article about Canada's increasingly close ties with Honduras, which is a coup government, a very violent, oppressive government, a government that, speaking of labor, it has made Honduras, I guess next to Colombia, one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a labor activist, with dozens being killed and journalists as well. And when Michael Ignatieff was here in Victoria running for prime minister a couple of years back, you know, I asked him why his party was supporting the Canada-Colombia free trade bill that Mr. Harper and his group had put together. And after some, you know, stumbling, he said, well, it was because of engagement that...
Oh, yes, this is always, you know, we must engage. This is how we can really change things. But look at how Harper's engaging at the Organization of American States by undermining Cuba's entry into it. I just posted something about it saying, well, in the future, you know, they're talking about perhaps only having another one if Cuba can be involved.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe it should be the Organization of Latin American States. And I remember years ago, I can't remember the name of the president. Was it Coolidge?
Calvin Coolidge?
I think President Coolidge made a statement in 1929 saying, all America belongs to the United States.
Right.
All America belongs to America. And Sandino, the radical, the revolutionary, said, and all Latin America belongs to the Latin Americans. I mean, it's just incredible what the U.S. has usurped over the years. And I often thought the U.S. should be referred to the U.S.ers or users. I thought that would be more appropriate than America. But, you know, this the way the way Harper has been acting at this conference is just unconscionable. I mean, it's no surprise, of course.
Well, this is it. I was going to say, are we that might be described as being on the left, which I'm not sure this is entirely accurate either, but have such low expectations of Mr. Harper and his group that it's kind of hard to feel disappointed about by him, only disappointed that there was so many Canadians that supported these... Well, I mean, in my view, fascist policies. I don't think there's any other way around it. Well, Joan, we're fast running out of time, but before we go, so is there anything that people can look up to get more information on both your projects and what you think important?
Well, we have we've been putting things up on YouTube, and it's under co-ops without a hyphen, not corporations. So if anyone wants to go and see some of the footage that's up there already.
And, of course, PEJ.org is the site that you manage, PeaceEarthAndJustice.org, an alma mater for me. And they can always keep up to date with breaking news that you won't get on the CBC or certainly not in the corporate press. Well, good luck on your trip, Joan. And
thank you very much.
Well, it's my pleasure, Joan. We'll have to get together when you come back, and then we can see get the benefit of your globetrotting then.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Okay, see you later then,
bye,
Joan.
For now.
Might I have your attention for just a moment, please? Wherever you might be, across the seven seas, serving in the armed forces of the mighty USA, heading off to save civilization, they say. There are things you should know before it's too late. You're working for an empire, the United States, which is despised everywhere for invasions like this one, for trying to rule the planet with bombs and guns. Yes, around the world, so many people agree, it's a great day to leave the army. They'll despise you in your uniform, but welcome you without it. Not there to bomb hospitals, just coming for a visit. No one thinks you're a liberator, those are the lies of the ones who will convince you to sacrifice your lives in the service of an empire wreaking havoc on the globe. You don't need to be a pawn, look away. You're gonna be a casualty, but around the world, so many people agree, it's a great day to leave the army. If you get there and find all the schools laid flat, you'll realize you never signed up for that. Get blown up by a Shahed drone before you even deploy to the war zone. You're radioactive from the dehumanitions, the wasteland it leaves after every invasion. So around the world, so many people agree, it's a great day to leave the army.
Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
The Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program was created by the Unison Fund to support Canadian music industry veterans. For more information on this lifeline of hope, visit unisonfund.ca.